Hello, and welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU provides each of our listeners with current information on a wide variety of topics related to athletic performance, body composition, anti-aging, fitness, and nutrition. On side one, Corey will provide a clinical review of articles published in various health and fitness journals, as well as his own personal commentary. He will then be joined by Tracy Hawley to discuss health and fitness issues which pertain to female athletes, mothers, and children. Side 2 includes an interview with our special guest, who will share their expertise and experience as a clinician, author, healthcare provider, athlete, or professional in the healthcare and sports nutrition field. Here is Corey Hawley and this month's presentation of Sports Nutrition Update.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Sports Nutrition Update, December 2002. Last month, I talked about muscle and how it functions in the body. Muscle is our fat-burning engine. It drives our metabolic rate up, and it also sustains our immune system. The technical term, as you'll recall, for a single muscle cell or fiber is myocyte. In this segment, I'll talk about the different subsets of muscle fibers, how they get their energy for contraction, and discuss how muscle actually grows. Muscular contraction depends chiefly on adenosine triphosphate, known as ATP, for fuel and energy. ATP must be continuously resynthesized since its reserves are fractional. Working muscles can deplete stored ATP in as little as 4 to 5 seconds. ATP is the ultimate energy currency that generates the power and life force behind all performance. It is harvested from the food we eat through oxidation, and because only small quantities are stored in each cell, it must be continually resynthesized at a rate equal to its utilization. The average person can bank up to 100 grams, or about 3.5 ounces, of total stored ATP. ATP cannot be absorbed from the blood or supplied by other tissues. It's too large to pass through the cell membrane, and its high molecular weight also makes it too large to be absorbed from the intestinal tract. You can't take ATP in the form that it exists directly, so you've got to encourage its production inside the body from raw materials. Each cell must make its own ATP from materials delivered from the bloodstream. This process is called de novo synthesis. Or it can recycle and rebuild ATP in the cell through complex biochemical salvage pathways. ATP is formed through the breakdown of glucose and fatty acids into carbon dioxide and water. This is known as aerobic respiration. And through glycolysis, which is the anaerobic or without oxygen breakdown of glucose to lactic acid. Aerobic pathways produce 20 times more ATP than anaerobic pathways. However, anaerobic respiration makes ATP about 2.5 times faster. Besides normal diffusion from the blood, smaller amounts of oxygen can also be obtained from myoglobin. Myoglobin is located inside the muscle cell. It functions similar to hemoglobin, just that it's specific to muscle cell activity. Myoglobin production can be enhanced with antioxidants, which buffer the redox cycle in favor of reduction. When oxygen levels inside muscle fibers diminish, the extra myoglobin becomes an asset. So anything that you can do to enhance myoglobin activity is a benefit to the athlete. Healthy muscle fibers contain a high-energy phosphate or phosphagen in the form of creatine phosphate, known as CP. Creatine phosphate can be utilized during muscular contraction for the rapid resynthesis of ATP by phosphate transfer to ADP, adenosine diphosphate. CP and ATP, or creatine phosphate and ATP, working together in the cell form the phosphagen system, which can extend a muscle's capacity to contract at near maximal forces for up to 15 seconds. The rate at which ATP is used up is determined by the power output of muscle during contraction. The harder and heavier you lift, the quicker the supply runs out. Chemically, the formula looks something like this: creatine phosphate, or CP, plus ADP, adenosine diphosphate, is moving forward in the equation to a free state of creatine plus ATP. So the phosphate from creatine phosphate is donated to ADP. It becomes ATP, and you've got more ATP for powering contraction. During low-level intensity activity, Energy for muscle contraction is supplied from ATP, derived from the oxidation of fatty acids and glucose. Plenty of oxygen must be available, and if it is, muscle acidity remains low enough for continuous function. However, when exercise becomes more strenuous, such as in sprinting or heavy lifting, intracellular ATP concentrations decrease quickly, and the regeneration of ATP at a rate close to that which is being depleted becomes the challenge. Muscle pH decreases, in other words, it becomes more acidic, as lactic acid and the hydrogen ions from the lactic acid increase, and so the environment becomes more acidic or the pH decreases. So it's the hydrogen ions produced and associated with lactic acid that reduces acidity. Excess ammonia also builds up, coupled with elevated blood phosphate, and free radical activity interferes with oxygen supply. Cytochrome C gets used up, and so all these factors contribute to the inability of muscle to function. Once ATP levels drop by 30%, fatigue becomes a limiting factor in performance. Supplementing with ribose, for example, can support the resynthesis of ATP and reduce recovery time. So ribose is useful for enhancing the production of ATP inside the cell. By the way, cytochromes are a class of hemoprotein involved in the transport of electrons and hydrogen. They contain small amounts of iron and facilitate energy transfer within the cell. During high-intensity exercise, energy for the resynthesis of ATP is met through the breakdown of creatine phosphate and anaerobic glycolysis, which is known as the glycogen lactic acid system. Because creatine phosphate is present in resting muscle in a concentration approximately 3 to 5 times that of ATP, a decline in maximum power output is often more reliant on the actual quantity of creatine phosphate levels than glycolysis. Raising levels of creatine phosphate within the myocyte is the basis of creatine supplementation. Of course, the best time to take creatine is after training, post-workout, with some carbs, some high-quality whey protein isolate, and some type of live oil rich in omega-3 fatty acids, such as flax or hemp seed oil. Human skeletal muscle is composed of various fiber types, which vary in function and physiological properties. The entire range, presently identified through histochemical staining, electrophoresis, and nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy, includes and consists of types 1, 1C, 2C, 2AC, 2A, 2AB, and 2B. That's a lot of fibers. The C fibers play a minor role in terms of actual numbers in adults, like 0 to 5%, although their numbers are initially higher in newborns, ranging up to 10 to 17%. So these seven fiber types are identified based on pH stability, lability of myofibrillar adenosine triphosphatase, which correlates to their myosin, we talked about myosin last time, heavy chain content. This sounds complex, and believe me, we can go deeper and blow some minds, but this is deep enough for now. Muscle fibers are generally classified according to twitch speed and color. Type 1 fibers, or slow twitch fatigue resistant red fibers, are associated with greater endurance and stamina. They contain high concentrations of myoglobin and mitochondria and have lots of blood capillaries. Type 2 fibers, or fast twitch white fibers, have less endurance but are faster, stronger, and appear white under a microscope. Type 2 fibers are divided into two specific groups. Type 2A, fast oxidative fatigue resistant, and they contain large amounts of myoglobin, high numbers of mitochondria, and a relatively high number of capillaries. Type 2B, which are fast glycolytic, very low resistant to fatigue, these are fibers that contain low levels of myoglobin and small numbers of mitochondria and blood capillaries. For general reference, muscle fibers are classified as slow, which is type 1, intermediate, type 2A, and fast, type 2B. White fibers demonstrate a greater potential for growth or hypertrophy. Hypertrophy describes the size increase in tissue, whereas when the fiber atrophies, it begins to shrink and degenerate and decay. So hypertrophy relates to growth and an increase in size. Muscle and the cell membranes of them contain higher numbers of androgen receptors. Now, these white fibers they contain more androgen receptors, which makes them more sensitive to the effects of testosterone. Heavy weightlifting forces neuromuscular recruitment and engagement of fast twitch fibers. Training to failure often enhances the effect. So intense training engages, especially with heavy weights and low reps, these fast twitch white fibers, and they're the fibers that can increase to the greatest potential, which means if you're trying to pack on meat on the body, you've got to focus on heavy training. But as we shall see, we need both higher reps with lighter training, intermediate, and the heavier low rep training. The motor unit and fiber type chosen by the body depends on the physiological requirement of demand based on properties inherent to a specific muscle type and contraction speed. The body chooses fast twitch type 2 fibers when the demand for strength and speed is presented. In contrast, it will choose slow twitch type 1 fibers to maintain posture or when endurance becomes a priority. And you develop what you use. And so this is when we get into the specificity of sport and genetics that relate to the fiber subsets that relate to the function of the body and whether or not you have equal percentages or more fast or slow twitch. Dr. Fred Hatfield, who authored Hardcore Bodybuilding, A Scientific Approach, points out the difference between fast and slow twitch muscle fibers, emphasizing that white or fast twitch fibers have little endurance but can double in size when trained explosively with heavier weights. On the other hand, red or slow twitch fibers have great endurance, respond best to high repetition training with lighter weights, but are limited to a maximum of 15% growth without the use of steroids. For improving muscular tone and size, a combination of both low and high rep training is recommended by Hatfield. In a nutshell, strenuous exercise induces a cell disruption effect, causing filament microtrauma and cell damage. This leads to an immediate adaptive response because the body will always react to changes that disturb its order and balance, known as homeostasis. Adaptation is defined as a change in structure, function, or form that improves the chance of survival for an organism contained within a specific environment. Inflammation, changes in reduction, oxidative pathways, immune alteration, and tissue repair are just some of the reactions and biological processes associated with the effects of training, the outcome of which is the desired objective of building new fiber, or what we call fiber remodeling. This is hypertrophy and is associated with improved muscle twitch response. So how do muscles grow? Well, through the use of an electron microscope, muscle biopsy, and radioactive tracing techniques, research scientists are able to look at muscle to determine how it responds to the influence of exercise and the stress of load. Before muscle gets bigger or stronger, you have to influence the genes inside the nucleus of each muscle cell. This is achieved through both training and diet. Never underestimate the power of nutrition when it comes to growing muscle. Gene expression is altered by satellite cells, which re-enter the cell cycle in response to various levels of exercise and fitness activity. These satellite cells alter gene expression according to the amount and form of stress imposed on muscle, thereby affecting its size and shape. Micronutrients like vitamins and minerals also influence genetic expression in that the presence or absence of specific nutrients, fatty acids, minerals, trace elements, and amino acids, and the coenzymes they affect, can improve or hinder satellite cell formation and thus influence how muscle fibers respond. Muscle tension and muscle torque provide the force generating capacity that powers intense muscle contraction. Muscles get bigger when the number of myofibrils inside them increases, and this adaptation depends on the availability of specific amino acids, hormones, and enzyme chemistry, all of which play a role in protein synthesis. Muscle cells have many nuclei, which control the rate of protein synthesis. Proteins are put together from amino acids on the surface of structures in the cell called ribosomes. This process is controlled and managed through genetic transcription and translation. Within 4 days of a workout, it's possible to identify genetic changes within the cell that alter muscle fiber contractility. The effects of these changes are initiated the minute you start training and begin to reverse and slowly regress or move backwards after more than 72 hours of downtime. This is known as the detraining period. So as a function of detraining, you begin to lose that which you gain, and it takes about 4 days or 72 hours. Muscle hypertrophy is also influenced by neural activation, muscle stretch, muscle recoil, and elasticity. We're looking at plyometrics, jumping exercises, and speed training, and these are known to enhance neural activation even more so than intense overload lifting. Plyometrics involves exercises that test and enhance elasticity and change the recoil of muscle tissue in favor of generating more power and speed. The rate of protein synthesis is also influenced by the rate at which amino acids enter the cell. Most amino acids enter muscle cells with assistance from insulin via the action of what is known as a sodium pump. Insulin metabolism combined with growth hormone, insulin-like growth factors called somatomedins, and several androgens like testosterone or DHEA and androstenedione made in the body greatly influence the entire process. This is why many athletes use anabolic steroids. However, the natural athlete can also influence the turnover rate of protein in favor of muscle accretion or buildup by adjusting his or her food composition, training correctly, and taking advantage of special dietary supplements like glutamine, HMB, whey protein isolate, and creatine. Most skeletal muscles contain a mixture of muscle fiber types, and their proportion is influenced mainly by genetics, the action of the muscle, and adaptation to physical activity and exercise. For instance, endurance exercise, such as long-distance running or cycling, can cause a gradual transformation of type 2B fibers into type 2A fibers. The reverse is also true with strength and speed event training, such as powerlifting. Muscle biopsies on sprinters and strength-trained athletes show high proportions of well-developed fast-twitch fibers. Unless you're extremely active and stimulate muscle growth through resistance training, the total number of skeletal fibers you are born with will most likely never change, although muscle fibers do decay and wither away over time if not routinely stimulated. So we can definitely influence muscle function, muscle strength, and muscle size through our lifestyle, through nutrition, and through training, and a lot of other variables associated with health and fitness. Well, guess what? We've run out of time again. I'll continue talking about muscle in the new year because muscle is really where it's at and what it's all about. Thanks for listening. And here's a quote from Andre Gide. In order to be utterly happy, the only thing necessary is to refrain from comparing this moment with other moments in the past, which I often did not fully enjoy because I was comparing them with other moments of the future.